Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for joining me once again as we continue our look through the big old binder of old baseball cards as we are moving through the final cards from the 1950s I have. Now, I have more than what I have for 1958 when we're talking 1959 Tops. I had one card in 58 Tops. It was Jerry Staley. 59 Tops, I've got several, just a few more, like so probably 8 or 9 cards here. So finding the random card was a pretty easy process here. But a very interesting story about our random selection and the team that he played for, Eddie Mixus, or as Branch Rickey once said, Mixus will fix us. As Eddie Mixus featured here with the Cincinnati Redlegs, of course, better known as the Cincinnati Reds right now, as he was wrapping up his career, card number 58 in the 59 top set. So we will go through the interesting story of Eddie Mixus in a little bit and go through the very colorful 1959 top set, although this particular card not extremely colorful just because it's a little faded over time. It's lost a little bit of its color, but still, the entire set, just basically a continuation of what Topps did in 1958 with all sorts of colors and some very interesting artistic designs here. Topps was very much in a very almost marketing or advertising art phase in the late 1950s. In fact, you can look at the 58 and 59 Topps cards as almost the Mad Men sets in Topps. They would finally break away from that and get into some while artistic, still some straightforward baseball cards in the 1960s, but definitely in the late 50s. Topps was experimenting a little bit with different colors and designs, and it makes for some very, very memorable cards. In fact, the 59 Topps template is one of the designs that you can make your own Topps baseball card if you go to Topps.com. They've got, I think, probably about 10 different designs now. Of course, you've got the 87 Topps, you've got 86 Topps, you've got the 2016 and 2017, but they also have a few of the older card designs, including 59 Topps, so it's kind of neat to see that. And we'll again talk about 59 Topps and the cool design in just a little bit. After we talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, very interesting group of comments on Wax and Gum Stains. First of all, in regards to our announcement that we are on iHeartRadio, Peter K. Steinberg, congrats, iHeart, Wax Ecstatic. Well, very nice, Peter. And thank you for passing along the word there. And also, thanks to our friend in San Diego, Sleep Frank, who had a little trouble finding where it is on the iHeartRadio app, but he was able to, after some very heady detective work, was able to track it down. He says if you go to Podcast Games and Hobbies on the tab, you can find Wax Ecstatic. So if you visit iHeartRadio.com, just type in Wax Ecstatic on the search page, and you will find it there. Or if you have it on mobile, I found it through search. Now, I have an iPhone. I found it through search. There's just a little magnifying glass. You just tap on that, type in Wax Ecstatic, and it came up. But perhaps some mobile devices, you need to go to Podcast Games and Hobbies, type in the name, and you will find it. But the iHeartRadio podcast stream that features all of our new shows and also our entire archive. So that's just another way that Wax Ecstatic comes your way, as it also comes your way via iTunes and Audio Boom. New episodes on Tuesdays and Flashback Friday episodes on Friday. And we remind you throughout the weekend about the Flashback episodes. And speaking of Flashback episodes, that's where a lot of our comments this week have come from. And that is the 87 Topps set. And these Flashback episodes are kind of at random. You know, there's a little thought and consideration into which ones I pick to throw back out there once again. But 87 Topps, for the majority of collectors, that is a favorite. Now, that is not always the case. There are the few exceptions of people that don't like it. For example, Matthew McClure writing back, "This set may have been one of the main reasons I drifted away from collecting." And I remember when we were talking about the 87 top set, and this was several months ago, we had somebody who said that they stopped collecting after 87 tops. They thought the whole wood grain look was too hokey and too cartoonish, and that's kind of where the hobby started getting away. And of course, in 1988, you added Score, in 89, you added Upper Deck, and you know the slippery slope began. But for most collectors, 87 tops is still very much loved. And all you have to do is look at her comments. Baseball cards, ESP, one of my absolute favorite sets from the junk wax era. Ryan Stonebreaker, still love that set. Hoping to pick up some at a local card shop this weekend to open Monday. Well, I hope you were able to do that, Ryan. David Strang, fun box. Last, Pete Rose, and first, Barry Bonds. That's right. The Bonds rookie is still one of the, in fact, probably the strongest card in terms of value in that set. Of course, you still have Jose Canseco's first Topps card. He had a card in the 86 traded set, which is his true rookie card. But you also had the Mark McGwire rookie card, although actually that wasn't his rookie card. I forgot he had his rookie card in 85 Topps, but a second-year Mark McGwire card, and also the rather famous Future Stars Bo Jackson card in there as well. Ben Adams chiming in with one of my favorite all-time sets. Also, Ryan Mickelson, first full wax box I ever bought with my allowance. One of my favorite sets along with 1983 Topps. Yes, 83 Topps is also right up there. And I believe it was during our, it was either 85 Topps or 86 Donruss or 86 Fleer podcast. One of those podcasts from around then. We did a random poll of our listeners, you know, what was the most influential set during your collecting days. And since we've gained a lot of listeners since then, we may just put that out there once again. Not right now, but makes for a fun conversation point. What is the most influential set that you collected or during the time that you collected? 87 Topps is right up there. That's my favorite. And 83 Topps is definitely up there as well. From Tony Warden, first year I ever bought a wax pack box from the local grocery store. Saved up my shoveling money all winter. And I love the 87 Topps set too, Tony, because even though I didn't collect it in mass until a few years later, in fact, I remember the summer of 1993. That was the year that I just, for whatever reason, took my allowance money. Actually, it wasn't my allowance. It was the money that I made mowing my neighbor's yard, which I think I got paid $15 or $20 to do. It was a pretty big yard. And, you know, growing up in Florida, the grass grows rather quickly in the summer. So that was a pretty good source of income for 3 or 4 months. But I would, once I got $20, I would go down to one of my local card stores and buy a cello box of 87 Topps. And I must have collected enough for 3 or 4 complete sets through that. Also, speaking of flashback episodes, a comment from the 89 Score episode, and considering 89 Score is one of my least favorite sets, very interesting to see this comment, and I absolutely agree with the person who sent it, and that would be Kay Alcott. Listen to 89 Score show. Totally agree. Edgar Martinez is a Hall of Famer. Loved comment on New York media humping Mariano Rivera's leg, i.e. bias. Yeah, I have a subtle way of putting things, if you couldn't figure that out there. But yeah, even though the 89 Score set was an absolute drag, the guy that was on our random poll, Edgar Martinez, who should be in the Hall of Fame, in my opinion, and again, I'll make the argument, because people always, they look at his career as a designated hitter, and most of his career was in that position, but he was a designated hitter not by choice, but by necessity. He tore up his knee in spring training of 1992. He was actually an all-star at third base in 1991. So, you know, it wasn't like this guy was totally one-dimensional. After he messed up his leg, he had to, you know, shift to that position. And by necessity, he cranked out a good, 12 or 13 years after that. And certainly his numbers speak for themselves. An interesting tweet that was sent in by WaxPack916 over the weekend. He sends a picture of a pile of cello packs, or excuse me, rack packs from 1985 and 86. And he says, what do you think? 285 tops and 986 tops for $15. Not a fan of 86, but couldn't pass up on this deal. I agree with you. You can't pass it up. And I commented back to him. I said, the 285 rack packs make it worthwhile. Because if you think about it, you're getting 986 tops rack packs and 285 tops. Well, for $15, think of it this way. You're paying $7.50 for each of the 85 tops rack packs. And maybe you get a Meguiar. Maybe you get a Roger Clemens. Maybe you get a Sandberg or a Gwynn or a Ripken. You know, those big cards or Boggs, you know, third, fourth year cards for a lot of the young stars of the 1980s and 90s. And the 86 tops are thrown in for free. That's the best way I could put it. I was never a big fan of the design of 86 tops either. However, it's fun to go ripping into them, and especially, you know, the rack packs, because they don't make those anymore. I wish they did. Tops did up until about 10 years ago. But it was always fun ripping, you know, cell after cell and going through all of them. And, you know, the fact that you had, 48 cards in each of these, plus the glossy All-Star card. Yeah, remember those? We did a podcast on those a few weeks ago. And it looks like you already hit the jackpot with one of those 86 tops rack packs. Cal Ripken right there front and center on that top rack pack. So, I mean, you know, it's worth only a couple dollars these days. But, hey, you know, even though 86 tops was the bulk of that purchase there, you still get 11 rack packs from over 30 years ago for $15. That is a steal. And that's why I tell people, don't poo-poo these cards from, you know, what we call the junk wax era. Yeah, there's still a lot of 86 and enough 85 stuff out there to, you know, depress the market a little bit. You're not going to be, you know, paying off mortgages or student loans with some of these cards, but they're still fun to rip open and look at, and especially those designs. I was never a big fan of 86, but 85, as we mentioned in the 85 Tops podcast, the Cyndi Lauper card, the very MTV look for 1985. Mark writing to us, and I'm assuming that he's talking about the cards from the 1950s that we were talking about. Why can't baseball cards of today be more like this of yesteryear? Memories. Well, whether it's cards of the 1950s or cards from the 1980s, and you were actually replying to our tweet about the 1958 Topps set, you know, times change. You know, there's something very neat about some of these older cards and these older sets. There's no doubt about it. And I think the fact that there is a certain vintage look and feel to these, yet there's also a timeless aspect to a lot of these cards, makes it so special. It's hard to replicate cards like this. And, you know, Mark, I think the closest you can get to making current cards like these older cards is through the Topps Heritage sets. And I am just absolutely devouring the 2017 Topps Heritage. I've always liked 68 Topps. That's what that set is designed like. And, you know, I've been very good about it, you know, after going a little crazy with the baseball card purchases last year. I now just do it, twice a month, basically when I get paid, and, you know, make that run to Target, because I don't have too many local card shops around where I live. Make that run to Target, get one of those hanging boxes that have the 35 cards in it. And because I'm getting them at Target, you also get the 1968 game cards and mini cards are thrown in. I actually got a Carlos Beltran mini card in the last box I bought. So, you know, not spending too much, not going overboard, but I am just absolutely loving the 68 Topps look on the 2017 Topps Heritage. So if you're looking for cards of today with the old designs, that's, you know, in my opinion, the best way to go. You can also go Topps Archives. To me, that's going a little overboard. They just kind of slap every player on every design. So I like it, you know, slow and steady. One year there's a new look, and, you know, 68 Topps looks absolutely fantastic in the 2017 players and teams. One other thought from Wax and Gum Stains that we want to pass along to you. This was a question that Ben Adams asked me. What's the one card you wish you wouldn't have traded away or gotten rid of? And, you know, we had, again, in a previous podcast, I threw a question out there. What's the one bad trade that you have ever made in baseball cards? And I had to really rack my brain on this. I thought, you know, I've been very lucky. I have not really had any truly terrible bad trades in cards. I've been very fortunate to where I set my sights on what I'm looking for and I'll try to acquire it. Very few times did, you know, somebody make an offer to me that I accepted. The one time that I did accept somebody's trade, I made off like a bandit because this was dealing with football cards. This guy was a Notre Dame fan, and I had a 91 Bowman card of some rookie who had played with Notre Dame the year before. So the picture had him, you know, in his Notre Dame stuff. And, you know, he offered me a couple cards in return, and I didn't really have any, you know, connection to this Bowman card. So I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever. But one of the cards that he gave to me in return, which is still in mint condition and is still locked down in a very thick plastic holder, was the third string backup quarterback for the Atlanta Falcons, a guy named Brett Favre, whose name was misspelled on the 91 Top Stadium Club card that I got. So I was very fortunate. I didn't make a whole lot of bad deals. However, and I shared this on the Twitter feed, to which Beans Ball Card Blog retweeted with "Wow" as the commentary. I've told this story before. I'll tell it again. But I remember back in 1990, I want to say. I don't remember when during 1990, but somewhere in 1990, my family went to a Toys R Us store. Now, this is back in the day when Toys R Us was not as widespread as it is now. Now, and especially here in Tampa, and you've got a lot of suburbs and a lot of different communities, you know, there's a Toys R Us in every suburb. So, you know, if you go 30 minutes in any direction, you'll find a Toys R Us. Well, back then, there were only maybe two stores in the area, and I didn't live close to one of them. Well, for whatever reason, we happened to be at this Toys R Us, and I remember near the front of the store, they had a baseball card section. And in 1990, that's when I was going full speed ahead buying baseball cards. It was my first full season of buying cards. And I tried, you know, every different brand that was out there. And I remember there was a big metal bin, and it was full with 1990 Donruss rack packs. And back then, I think those sold for a dollar, I want to say. The same thing as the Topps rack packs we were just talking about. You know, you got like 45 or 48 cards, something like that. And we've ridiculed 90 Donruss, the big ketchup red cards here. So there's this big red bin, basically all these, you know, hundreds and thousands of these red cards looking right back at you. And I remember I'm looking at it, and I'm just kind of like fishing through here. And I remember finding a rack pack of 1975 Topps. And I still, I mean, it's been almost 30 years. I still kick myself to this day because me being what, 12 or 13 years old at the time, I'm not thinking about 75 Topps. I'm looking at the 1990 cards here. And I don't know how that rack pack got in there. I know over the years, retailers such as Walmart and Target and, you know, perhaps Toys R Us then or Kmart would occasionally cycle in just old product. Like I remember a few years ago going to a Walmart and they just had an 87 Fleer update set that, you know, was on sale for like $6. Sure. Okay. So, you know, occasionally you get some older product that just for whatever reason, I don't know how it gets there, but it gets repackaged and put out there. And for some reason, there was a 75 Topps rack pack. It was probably marked at a dollar or two, which makes it even worse. And I didn't buy it. And I wish I did, because I may not have even hit a single star card or rookie card or whatever. But just the idea of having a 75 rack pack. And had I kept it in mint condition, you know, I could probably resell that now for a few hundred dollars, which, I mean, we can always use a few hundred dollars, right? So to answer your question, Ben, and again, if you've heard the story before, I apologize, but, you know, just trying to catch up with everybody. I never really had any bad one-on-one trades with cards, but boy, did I really, you know, take it in the shorts with that one. That was just so tough for me. You know, looking back at it going, geez, I could have had a rack pack, 75 Topps. swimming amongst thousands of 1990 Donruss cards of all things. So somebody in Tampa 27 years ago made off like a bandit finding that 75 Topps rack pack. And I can only imagine there were probably two or three more floating around in this bin had I bothered to look. Oh, well. Regrets, I've had a few, but fortunately not too many over the years of collecting. So if you have any stories to share, any comments about any of the podcasts that we have, any of the players that we feature, feel free to do so at any time at Wax and Gum Stains on our Twitter feed. And please continue to share Wax and Gum Stains with your friends, those people who collected back then or who collect now. Always good to just keep the hobby talk going, whether it's about our podcast or just anything in general. We certainly appreciate your comments. Now, as for 59 Topps, a very interesting set because it is in many ways a continuation of the 58 Topps set. Now, if you recall, the 58 Topps set was a very basic set using the full-color photographs of players, but instead of the 57 Topps approach where they just took the entire photo and just put it right on top of the front of the card, the 58 Topps basically cropped out the player and put the player photo on top of a very colorful background. Well, in 1959, you saw a very similar approach by the Topps company, where you had the nice colored backgrounds again, and you had the real-life photographs of players as well. But there was a really unique and, like I said, very Mad Men advertising marketing look to these cards. That it says 1959 right out of the gate. And if you look at the Eddie Mixes card, again, card number 58 from our random pull here, you'll see, first of all, this is another beaten-up card, but again, I'm not a big critic about how beaten up some of these cards, certainly off-center, which was a very common problem with cards in the 1950s and 60s. But you'll see that on this particular card, you've got this kind of a lime green background on top of the white frame. But instead of just having the full-color background with the player photo kind of pasted on top of it, every player, his photo is part of a circle that is right on the middle of the card. So you have the color background with the circle, and in the middle of the circle is the picture of the player. And the best way that I can liken this is it's almost like a photographer's view of a player. Or if you're into the spy movies, kind of the gun barrel view of James Bond, you know, at the very beginning of the movies. So you kind of have that look here. I think it's more of the photographer's view. But this was very appropriate for the time. Again, photography and shapes and all these different colors, very big in this artistic experimentation in the late 1950s. So the standard card, you had the different colors in the background, you had the circle, and then you had the player's photo in the middle. Also, what makes this set unique is the player's name is spelled out in all lowercase letters. Of course, the proper way to write somebody's name is you capitalize the first letter of the first and last name. Well, every player's name was all in lowercase, so that's very unique to this set. The player's name written at the top of the card, but also at a slight angle. And at the bottom of the card, you would have the team logo and the team name on the bottom. The logo would be on the left-hand side, the team name would be on the right-hand side, and then the player's position at the bottom. Now, what's neat about this card is you have the classic, not just Cincinnati Reds logo, but the Cincinnati Redlegs, as the Cincinnati Reds were claiming starting in 1953. They said, well, you know, we were once called the Red Stockings and the Red Legs, and they were trying to claim that this was a, attempt to kind of go throwback in the 1950s, if you will. But one newspaper speculated, and in fact, there's a lot of smoke to this fire. Remember, in 1953, this was at the peak of McCarthyism. That is, Senator Joe McCarthy from the state of Wisconsin, who was just going out on a witch hunt trying to find anybody who he didn't see as fitting the norms of Americans. And he would accuse these people of being communists. And some of them actually did have, sympathy towards the Communist Party or communist people. But again, in the early 1950s, as you had the Cold War ramping up massively between the Soviet Union and the United States, being labeled a communist was scarlet letter type stuff here. Of course, the nickname for a communist back then was a red. So if you were labeled a red, then, you know, people said, well, you must be a communist. You must be a communist sympathizer. So it was quite the dirty word back then to be labeled red. And of course, there was a very popular saying back then, better dead than red, to imply that I'd rather be dead than be a communist. So the Cincinnati Reds, you know, the baseball's oldest professional team, have been playing since 1869. Well, they get kind of caught up in the political fervor of the time and decide to, put up this cockamamie story that this is just an extension of the Red Stockings, their original name, when many people could surmise, and appropriately so, that the name Red Legs was an attempt to kind of get away from the Reds term back then. And that was something that you saw from 1953 through 1960. So again, 1953 was the peak of McCarthyism, but the Red Scare that was going on at that time, going on throughout the 1950s. And finally, by 1961, cooler heads prevailed and realized, you know, this is kind of silly. So they stopped that. They went back to being called the Cincinnati Reds. And of course, that's what they're known as now. But right in the middle of the communist Red Scare of the 1950s, the Reds got caught up in it, opting to go with the name Red Legs throughout that time. So you not only have this neat classic logo on this particular card, but a little history lesson here too, when the Reds were called the Red Legs for several seasons. Now, if you flip the card over, a very memorable design to the back of the 59 Topps card, as you have this very Christmassy look to it, as the card number is in a white color on top of a dark green box. Going across the top of the card, you have the player's name and personal information in a red box. And then right beneath it, you have the complete Major League batting record, in this case for Eddie Mixes. So again, going back to what Topps used in 1957 and 58, they just did the one line and the, you know, cartoon presentation. So Topps getting a little bipolar here, going from full stats to one line, back to full stats. They would go back to one line in 1960, and I believe 61 as well. So they kind of went back and forth before settling in on the full stats from 1963. Moving forward, again, the only exception after 1963 would be 1971, and then that didn't change until much later on down the line. But anyways, you've got the complete Major League batting record here. Eddie Mixes, a longtime member of the Brooklyn Dodgers, had a stint in the Navy in 1945 and 46. Now, that is not noted here. That is a departure from the Pee Wee Reese card that we showed you in 57 Tops, where there was a line that noted his military service. So that was starting to slowly disappear from the annals of history in the backs of baseball cards. But you've got his complete stats here, also a stray red mark. That's another danger of some of these older cards. You know, kids used to mark them up. But also what's really funny is the little bio here, and this is something where, again, you know, Topps the year before was using cartoons to tell these stories. Well, they decided to use text here. And the text for Eddie Mixes is pretty funny. Just toss a glove at Eddie and he's ready to play. He's seen plenty of action in both leagues at second, third, shortstop, and outfield. So that's a very nice way of saying Eddie Mixes is a utility guy. Don't look for him to hammer the ball that hard. And all you have to do is look at his career numbers. You know, 14 years, appeared in over 1,000 games, and he had a career batting average of .236. Only had 44 home runs, 228 RBI. So Eddie Mixes was definitely the prototypical middle infielder, much better known for his fielding prowess than his hitting. And we'll talk about Eddie Mixes in a moment. But when you look at this card, Again, 59 tops, and this card is, again, slightly faded. This is on the full white cardstock. This was the first year that Topps experimented with this. Now, what's interesting is, and I never noticed this until I went looking through my binder, but not every card printed was on this white cardstock. You had some that were on the classic gray cardstock, and the cardstock that Topps would use for many, many years throughout the 1970s and 80s and into the early 90s. So you have an interesting mix of the gray cardstock and the white cardstock. This one is the pure white cardstock. But again, a very, Mad Men is the best way I can put this. This is a Madison Avenue marketing firm, ad agency baseball card. You've got the pastel colors, which, as we mentioned in 58 Tops, were very popular with the time, very popular with cars, with fashion magazines, with clothing styles, with advertising and public relations, with color TV starting to grow in the late 1950s, color films as well, which had been around for a while, but, you know, color was becoming the main way of media being delivered to people, whether it was on film, in television, or even print media. You know, you saw more full color stuff. So companies were taking advantage of that. So you have, you know, light green, or like in the case of the Bob Gibson rookie card, and that's the key rookie card in the set, a pink background. You have that photographer's lens look here with all the players featured inside a circle in the middle of the card. The rather unique lowercase name presentation, and then the classic logos with the team names at the front, and a very simple but unique back to the card. Again, the Christmas design, Christmas colors make this a very memorable set. Now, a couple other notes about the 59 Topps set. This was a huge set. You know, Topps sets from 57 through 58 through 59 started growing by leaps and bounds. In fact, the 59 Topps set is about 165 cards larger than the 57 Topps set, 572 cards in the set. You had some rookie star cards. That was one of the subsets in 59. The baseball thrills, which featured highlights from throughout the season. The sporting news all-stars. Remember, in 1958, it was Sport Magazine. Well, in 59, a little more street cred to those cards. The sporting news all-stars, which rounded out the set, cards number 551 through 572. Now, the high number series in 59 Tops, numbers 507 through 572, according to several resources I've looked at here, the smallest series in the set, so a very limited run here, and that, of course, is part of the downside of making a larger set. These later series, basically this fifth series in the set, coming in very late in the season, being made in shorter numbers, not only because it was later in the season, but depending on who was, you know, the wholesalers who were buying these cards. Well, if they had a ton of Series 1, 2, and 3 already just sitting around their store, they weren't going to order Series 4 and 5. So you had less out there in the market anyways. So some very tough cards to come along. So some very valuable cards at the tail end of this set. Also should note the Mickey Mantle card in this set, depending on the condition. I've seen some prices, if you can find a PSA 10, good luck, because that will cost you $2,000 to $3,000. I've seen some lower grade cards priced anywhere from $100 to almost $1,000, and that's for like PSA 6 and below. Of course, Mickey Mantle at the peak of his career in 1959, but also because of that was so far at the beginning of the set, that was typically a card that was abused a lot because, as we know, you know, kids back then, you put the cards either in a shoebox or you wrapped rubber bands around them. Well, often the card, the first few cards in a set were the most abused because of the rubber bands, or they were handled the most. So the Mickey Mantle card, if you're looking for that, very difficult to find. So a very unique set, a very time capsule set. There's a very 1959 look and feel to this, but that's what makes this set even more of a classic. Not only does it fit in the times then, but it certainly still has legs now. And it is one of my favorites from this time era because it is unique. It is very colorful. You've got a lot of great stars and also some great stories behind common players like Eddie Mixis. But you also have a unique design here that Topps never really leaned on anything like this again. They never had kind of the full, bright, vivid colors quite like this. You know, they've had some colorful cards over the years, but not like this late 1950s design. Never did they do, at least to my knowledge. I'm racking my brain here just to make sure I'm not goofing up. I don't believe they ever had the full lowercase presentation of the player's name and the very unique color combination on the back of the card. I don't believe, and again, I'm just racking my memory here, just going set by set throughout the 60s and 70s. I don't think they ever had a Christmas-like look to the backs of the cards. That's what makes 59 Topps stand out even more all these years later. Now, when you look at Eddie Mixis, at first it doesn't seem like a very spectacular or extraordinary career, but I found some pretty interesting stories about him. Again, some credit to the Sabre folks, that of course the Society for American Baseball Research, Peter Gordon writing a great article on Eddie Mixis, and through several other resources I was looking at, found some interesting stories behind this guy. Now, what's interesting about this particular card is Eddie Mixis wasn't even playing Major League Baseball when this card was made. In fact, he played his final game on September 28th of 1958. So the 59 season, there wasn't one for him. He had retired, moved on to a career as a salesman for a trucking company. It's always fascinating when you look back at these players and what they were doing after their playing career, and Mixis is no exception here. In fact, it's pretty amazing that here's a guy who was in the major leagues for many, many, many years and played for some pretty good teams too, especially those Brooklyn Dodger clubs in the late 40s. And he's going out and being a salesman for a trucking company. But anyways, you know, 1958 would be his last season. So this photo of smiling Eddie Mixis of the Cincinnati Redlegs, this was it for him, basically. He wouldn't see any more Major League Baseball after this point. So even though his career had ended by the time that this card was made, some interesting points about Eddie Mixis, who, again, if you just look at his stats, it's just like a standard utility infielder. He was actually defensively a pretty solid infielder for the Dodgers. And as I mentioned, the Branch Rickey line, Mixis will fix us, as Rickey was building the Dodgers up in the early 40s and mid-40s, trying to find a good combination of defensive wizardry up the middle, the old school way of building a baseball team. You had your power on the corners and your defensive gems at second, short, and center. Well, Mixis came in, played briefly in the 1944 season. As I mentioned, went overseas, worked with the Navy in 1945 and early 1946, joined the Dodgers late in the 1946 season. Well, in 1947, he would have a tremendous moment in his career. Again, an otherwise, I don't want to say forgettable career, but, you know, an otherwise average career when you look at ballplayers from back then. But he was in the 1947 World Series, Dodgers and Yankees. Game four, Dodgers are down 2-1 in the series. And Bill Bevins is trying to get the first no-hitter in World Series history. This is, 9 years before Don Larson did it. Well, there were a couple of base runners who were on, and Mixis goes in and pinch runs for Pete Reiser. So two outs, bottom of the ninth inning, Cookie Lavaghetto smashes a ball into right field, and it's a double. So this is the first hit of the game. Well, Mixis, because he got such a good lead off of first base, there was a runner at first and second. He had such a good leadoff. Well, Mixis ends up scoring the game-winning run in the World Series. It evened up the series at 2, and it was one of the biggest moments in Brooklyn Dodger history prior to, of course, winning the 1955 World Series. Now, he would appear in the 1949 World Series with the Dodgers as well. And even though he wasn't a regular in the Dodger infield, this was a guy who you could plug in to give Jackie Robinson a day off, to be a good defensive partner with Pee Wee Reese, or as Robinson often played first base early in his career, you would have Robinson at first, Mixis at second, and Reese at short. So they had a pretty solid defensive group in the infield, especially on that right side of the infield. Well, it seems like he's going to be making a living in Brooklyn, but in 1951, he becomes part of a pretty big trade and controversial for Dodger fans, because the Dodgers had something going really well. They were leading the National League, I think, by 14 games in the middle of June. Well, on June 15th, 1951, he and Bruce Edwards, Joe Hatton, and Gene Hermansky are traded to the Chicago Cubs for Andy Pafko, Johnny Schmitz, Wayne Terwilliger, and Rube Walker. Now, a couple of these players would be key performers for the Dodgers several years later when they won the World Series in 1955, but at the time, it was a little bit of a head-scratcher because, again, the Dodgers were leading by 14 games, looked like they should have just run away with the entire National League pennant and perhaps charged into the World Series with a pretty, commanding head of steam going into the Fall Classic. Well, that wasn't the case. Shortly after the trade, the Dodgers start slipping a little bit, and then, of course, they give up the National League pennant on the last day, the infamous Bobby Thompson shot heard around the world on October 3rd of 1951, and that was a trade that Mixis really held against the Dodgers for many, many years. Like, wait a minute, what, you're leading by double digits in the middle of the season. Why are you trading away a bunch of guys on your team? So he ends up going to the Chicago Cubs, which was a real setback because, of course, the Cubs were not a very good team back then. But another interesting piece of baseball history happens during spring training of 1954. And I can't find the background story to this. I wish I could. I am looking everywhere for it, but I can't find it. So I'm curious if somebody out there has the backstory to this. But for some reason, Ernie Banks, then playing his first full season with the Cubs, he played the last several games of the 1953 season in Chicago. Well, for some reason, in spring training 1954, Ernie Banks doesn't have a glove. I can't figure out why Ernie Banks, who didn't play a day of minor league baseball, who came up straight from the Kansas City Monarchs of the Negro Leagues to the Chicago Cubs, as I mentioned, at the end of the 53 season, why he doesn't have a glove for about a week. Well, even though his job was at risk here, up for grabs, Mixis would let Banks borrow his glove. And that seems kind of funny and innocent at the same time, but let's again put ourselves into the time here. 1954 was the very, very beginning of some landmark race relations decisions. You had Brown versus the Board of Education that year. The next year, you had the beginning of the Montgomery bus boycott. And then from there, the battle for racial equality really took off for certainly the next 10 plus years, with Martin Luther King being at the centerpiece of that. Think too, even though it was in Chicago and it was a quote unquote progressive northern city, to have a white man willingly give up his glove to a black man and share this equipment is very unique. And again, I wish I knew what the background story of why did Ernie Banks not have a glove for several days in spring training. Now, I guess it's a good fortune that the Cubs were no longer training in Florida at this point in time. Prior to the 1940s, they were training in Florida because Florida was certainly dealing with its own segregation issues at the time. But still, in 1954, not all that common that you would have this kind of camaraderie between teammates, especially since, like I said, Mixis was potentially losing his job to this young, phenomenal star in Ernie Banks. Well, the one thing that I can think of, and I wish that Eddie Mixis was still alive so you could ask him this question. He actually passed away back in 2005 at the age of 78. But the one thing that I can think of that may have eased any kind of tensions here, first of all, Mixis was born in New Jersey, so perhaps a little more of a relaxed atmosphere in terms of race relations then, as opposed to somebody who was born and raised in the South. But speaking of somebody who was born and raised in the South, I go back to Pee Wee Reese, who, as we mentioned in our 57 Tops podcast, was born and raised in the Louisville, Kentucky area. And I can only think of what Pee Wee Reese did back in 1947 with Jackie Robinson, that very well publicized moment where in Cincinnati, while Robinson is just getting razzed not only by the fans in Cincinnati at Crosley Field, but there are certainly tensions within the Dodger clubhouse at that time. Not everybody was on board with Jackie Robinson just yet. when Pee-wee Reese, you know, during a pregame infield warm-up, walks up to Jackie and, you know, puts his arm around his shoulders, and they're walking, you know, together out in the field, and you know, that actually stunned the crowd. But as I mentioned in that 57 Tops podcast, that also sent a message to the people in the Dodger clubhouse, and that was that even though you had two people here who were of different colors, different backgrounds, and certainly different ways of being treated, they were still human beings, they were still grown men, and they were members of the same team. So, you know, like I said, I wish I could ask Eddie Mixkus what's going on here, but I would have to imagine in 1947, as Mixkus is part of this Dodger infield, and he's seeing his fellow teammates here getting along quite literally arm in arm, perhaps that planted a seed later on down the line, and granted, it's only 7 years down the line, but for whatever reason, Ernie Banks doesn't have a glove. And even though Eddie Mixkus was in a position to lose his job to a guy like Ernie Banks, he was still putting up a rather friendly offer to toss him his glove and let him use it there. So an interesting part in the career of Mixkus, I wish I had a little more backstory to why Ernie Banks didn't have his glove, but also, you know, what was Eddie Mixkus thinking here? Was he just, hey, it's a teammate, or was he, you know, trying to, you know, extend a helping hand to somebody else who, you know, hey, Ernie Banks, you know, growing up in Dallas, Texas, and going through the Negro Leagues and doing the barnstorming through the South, you know, here's a guy that didn't get an awful lot offered to him in a friendly manner. But, you know, here was a teammate who was offering to do that, and that was a very kind gesture, to put it very simply, from Eddie Mixkus. Now, Mixkus would continue his career with the Chicago Cubs. As Banks came in as one of two talented young infielders, this is where Mixkus actually became more of a utility player and got moved to the outfield. In fact, he appeared in 111 games in the outfield for the Chicago Cubs in 1955, also appeared in 33 games in the outfield in 1956, played more games at third base that year than he had the year before. And then from that point on in his career, he's basically just moved around in a pinch-running, pinch-hitting defensive replacement kind of situation. But he was still able to have a pretty lengthy career after the 1956 season, playing for the St. Louis Cardinals, also a very brief appearance with the Baltimore Orioles at the end of the 1957 season, and also played for Baltimore in 1958. He signed as a free agent, with Cincinnati in the middle of the 1958 season. And as I mentioned, his career ended at the end of the 1958 season, although officially released by the Red Legs March 20th of 1959. So basically during spring training 1959, he got the hook at the age of 31. He also, as I said before, moved on to a sales position in the trucking industry. And what's really funny, and again, this comes from the Sabre story here, and it's a really good read, but in 1964, when he became eligible for the Baseball Hall of Fame, he somehow received one vote for the Hall of Fame. And this caused a major uproar. People were going, wait a minute, why are you voting for Eddie Mixkus, a utility ball player, 236 career hitter? This is not Hall of Fame material. So there were all sorts of pitchforks and torches going on because of this. One newspaper called for a congressional investigation into Hall of Fame voting. And then sports writer Phil Pepe tracked down Eddie Mixkus. At this time, he was living in Huntington Valley, Pennsylvania. And he wanted his 2 cents, and Eddie said, and I quote, "I think the person who voted for me was a true baseball expert. He wasn't interested in statistics. He must have had a few beers before he made out his ballot," end quote. Well, Eddie Mixkus, the straight shooter, no doubt about that. So, you know, here's a guy who also apparently, when asked about his career, what his favorite part was, he said getting paid every 2 weeks. So You know what, guys? We always look back at the players of the 40s and the 50s, and we go, they played for the love of the game. Well, they were also getting paid a pittance, so they played for the paychecks as well. And Eddie Mixis was able to pull in quite a few of those with an unspectacular career. I mean, let's be honest here. But a 14-year career, again, over 1,000 games, appearing in two World Series with Brooklyn in 1947 and 1949. And even though his career was not spectacular, it crisscrossed certain points. A great moment in the 1947 World Series, a great gesture to a teammate of color in the 1954 spring training, and a very awkward Hall of Fame vote being cast his way well after he retired in 1964. So the interesting twists and turns in the life and career of one Eddie Mixis of the Cincinnati Redlegs, a team that also went through some very interesting twists and turns, as I mentioned, trying to avoid the Red Scare of the 1950s and altering their name for a few years. That was our random pull from the 1959 Top Set, card number 58 of 59 Tops. A very colorful, memorable set. Even though there's only one standout rookie card and plenty of star cards, still a design that is very emblematic of the time, but one that has still stood the test of time to the point where Topps still uses it as a template for the Make Your Own Baseball Card page on their website. And again, you could check that out because a lot of those templates are from the 1980s, and there's some that are more contemporary, but they do have a few from way back in the 50s and 60s, and one of them is this 59 Topps design. All right, if you have any thoughts about the 59 Topps set or anything about the hobby, again, you can post them on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains at any time. We certainly encourage that from all of our listeners. And again, we encourage you to share the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed with all of your friends and remind them that Wax Ecstatic comes your way with new episodes every Tuesday and with Flashback Friday episodes as we'll go back and look back at some of the stories behind some of the great sets from the 1980s and 1990s that we have already covered. Now, speaking of a great set, we're going to look at one next Tuesday as we travel back to 1960. If the 1958 and 59 sets were all about kind of the marketing Mad Men kind of advertising agency feel, well, 1960 got back down to business, and it was almost a modernized version of the cards that you saw in 1955 and 1956. So we'll take a look back at a very memorable set. I do have several cards, much like in 59. I've got maybe 8 or 9 cards from 1960, so we'll do a random pull from there. They're not star cards by any stretch of the imagination, so I'm sure we'll have some more very interesting Eddie Mixis-style stories to share with you. But it'll be a fun look at the 1960 Top Set, as we will do that on next week's edition of Wax Ecstatic. Again, the new episode coming your way on Tuesday. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic as we continue to flip the pages of the big old binder, find some interesting stories and some classic cards and some classic stories behind those individual cards as well. It's always fun going through this, and it's fun having you alongside. So we will be catching you again next week for a brand new edition of Wax Ecstatic.